What if the people meant to protect you were the ones helping you disappear? In the town of Cedar Hollow, girls have been vanishing for decades, their cases forgotten, their names erased, and the silence surrounding them louder than any siren. Former Detective Callum Riker thought his career ended with one cold case. But when a new victim goes missing in the exact same pattern, the ghosts of his past return, bringing with them fragments of memories he's no longer sure are his own. As Riker digs deeper, he uncovers a chilling conspiracy of psychological manipulation, buried police files, and a network powerful enough to rewrite reality. The closer he gets to the truth, the more he questions whether he's the hunter or just another victim who forgot what they took from him. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The First File. The wind had a strange way of whispering through Cedar Hollow. It curled between brick alleyways, slipped under courthouse doors, and carried things people didn't want to hear, like the name Ivy Monroe. Detective Callum Riker never forgot that name. Even after he left the force, even after the town buried her case beneath a pile of newer, messier crimes, Ivy's face haunted him every time he tried to sleep. She was only 17, vanished on a Tuesday. The official report said she left school at 3:12 p.m. Surveillance caught her turning onto Church Street. Then, nothing. No witnesses. No body. No phone. No trace. Just a backpack found near the old bus terminal with her name scrawled inside and one earring, the left one, tangled in the zipper. The case went cold, but Riker never could. They'd told him to move on. Too few leads, they said. Resources stretched thin. He tried. God, he tried. But every morning he poured the same black coffee, sat at the same table, and stared at that same case folder with the photo of Ivy taped to the front. She had freckles like stars and eyes like she already knew she wouldn't grow old. 3 years later, a second girl vanished. Different neighborhood, same pattern. This time, her name was Camilla Briggs, 22, part-time waitress, studying nursing at the community college. Her shift ended at 9 p.m. She never made it home. Her phone was later found near the same bus terminal. This time, Riker wasn't just haunted. He was furious. The town of Cedar Hollow had changed. New mayor, new police chief, new public image. But the same old silences lingered beneath the asphalt. Riker, now working as a private investigator, reopened the file unofficially. No badge, no backup, just instincts. And the sick feeling that these two cases weren't random. They were connected, and someone didn't want that truth found. He started with Ivy's mother. Monica Monroe lived in a small cottage that still smelled like grief. Photos of Ivy lined the mantel. Her bedroom remained untouched, as if time had frozen there the day she vanished. "She didn't run away," Monica whispered. "They tried to say she did, but my daughter wasn't the type. She was careful, scared of strangers. She always took the same route home." Riker nodded, flipping open his notepad. "Did she ever mention anyone following her? Anyone strange at school?" Monica hesitated. "She did mention someone." Riker looked up. "A man in a silver truck," she said. "Said he used to wait near the terminal. He'd smile, never speak. But Ivy told me she saw him more than once." There was no mention of a silver truck in the original file. Riker wrote it down. Another piece that had somehow disappeared from the puzzle. Back downtown, Riker watched the old terminal from across the street. It was mostly abandoned now. Graffiti on the walls, broken benches, vines creeping through cracks in the pavement. But he noticed something. A camera, mounted high above the corner entrance. He wasn't sure it had been there back then, but if it had, and no one reviewed the footage. He made a few calls, pushed favors, slipped the city clerk $100 in cash. Within 3 days, he had a stack of dusty hard drives from a forgotten archive room. He didn't expect much, but on the third hour of footage, from the day Camilla Briggs disappeared, he paused. There, at 8:53 p.m., a man in a silver truck pulled up just outside the lot. He sat still for 8 minutes, never left the vehicle, just watched. Headlights dimmed. Camilla walked past at 8:57. She vanished 2 blocks later. Riker leaned closer to the screen. The truck's license plate was partially obscured, but the last 3 digits were clear. 9FK. The next day, Riker ran every partial match he could find. One hit came up, a silver Ford F-150 registered to a man named Joseph Marchand, local, 42, no criminal record. But a strange pattern. He'd filed noise complaints on women in his building 4 times. Always claimed they were screaming for no reason. 2 had since moved out. Riker felt his stomach twist. He printed Marchand's photo and slid it into the folder with Ivy's and Camilla's. 3 faces. 3 timelines. 1 truth beginning to break through. And then his phone buzzed. Unknown number. He answered. A voice said, "You're making a mistake, detective." Then the line went dead. Chapter 2. The Missing Thread. The voice on the phone wasn't angry. It wasn't loud. That's what unsettled Riker most. It was calm, almost patient. Like whoever was on the other end had done this before and knew he wouldn't stop digging. He called the number back immediately, disconnected. Then he checked for a trace. Nothing. Burner. That wasn't ordinary. And nothing about this case ever had been. Riker stared at the manila folder spread across his dining table. Ivy Monroe, Camilla Briggs, Joseph Marchand. A timeline of women gone missing under the same moonlight, along the same shadowed streets, near the same forgotten bus terminal. His gut told him something else now. Ivy and Camilla weren't the only ones. He was chasing a pattern. The next morning, Riker drove to the county records building. If Marchand was involved, there had to be something. A complaint, a name, even a rumor. But what he found was far worse. Marchand had been married once, briefly, to a woman named Alana Drew. Marriage license filed in 2010. Divorce in 2011. No kids, no forwarding address, no further records. Riker checked DMV logs, property transfers, social media. Alana Drew had disappeared from every system like she never existed. He printed her marriage certificate anyway, just in case. As he left the building, his phone buzzed again. Blocked number. This time, the voice spoke clearly. "You keep looking into ghosts, Riker. But sometimes, ghosts look back." Click. Again, the line died. Riker froze in the parking lot, heartbeat pounding in his ears. There was no threat in the voice, but something worse. Certainty. Whoever was watching him wasn't afraid of being found. They were trying to remind him, "You've already failed before." That night, Riker called a contact at the local news station, a producer named Marcia Kimball. They'd worked together on a human trafficking piece 6 years ago. She owed him a favor. "Can you check something for me?" he asked. "Depends," she said. "What kind of trouble are you in?" "The kind with missing women. Do you have any archived footage on unsolved disappearances? Maybe stuff that never made air?" She paused. "Yeah. Our cold case reels go back 20 years. But they're a mess. What are you looking for?" "I don't know yet. I'll know it when I see it."
"Cryptic as ever," she muttered.
"Come by tomorrow morning. I'll clear a desk." He barely slept. When dawn came, he brewed the strongest pot of coffee he could make, shoved the folder into his bag, and drove to the station. Marcia was waiting in a cluttered back room with stacks of drives and unedited tapes.
You get 5 hours, she said, and don't spill coffee on anything. He started with reports from the late 90s. Grainy footage. Missing teens. Most of them were eventually found. But then, one face caught his eye. Casey Lynn Weller. Missing. 2001. Age 16. Vanished after choir rehearsal. Last seen walking past, of course, the same bus terminal. Riker froze the frame. She looked eerily like Ivy. Same eyes, same subtle freckle above the lip. But it wasn't just her features. It was the last known photo. The clothes, the angle of the shot. It looked posed. That wasn't police work. That was someone creating a collection. He ran Casey's case through the system. Still open. No leads. Never found. That made three girls, over two decades, all with eerily similar features, missing from the same place, never seen again. Ivy, Camilla, Casey, and maybe Alana Drew, though she was older, and never technically reported missing. Three verified, one ghost. He updated his board, drawing the red thread himself this time. He didn't even notice Marcia enter behind him. Jesus, she whispered. You think these are connected? Riker didn't answer, because he didn't think. He knew. Later that afternoon, he drove back to the old bus terminal. This time, he brought a flashlight and gloves. The city had padlocked the back entrance, but Riker still had friends in code enforcement. A few quiet calls, and the bolt was snipped. Inside, the air smelled like rust and rot. Rain had eaten through parts of the roof. Weeds grew through cracked tiles. But something about the space felt curated, like it had been used, not abandoned. In the far left corner near a gutted bench, Riker spotted something in the debris. A hair clip. He crouched, careful not to disturb it. It was dusty, but the gemstone glinted faintly in his flashlight beam. It matched the one Ivy Monroe was wearing in her last photo. His heart slammed once in his chest, and then he heard the floor creak behind him. He stood fast, flashlight aimed. But there was nothing. No footsteps. No voice. Just silence. Watching. Riker didn't sleep that night. He sat in his car outside Marchand's building, watching every light flicker in the windows. He didn't know what exactly he was waiting for. A confession? A mistake? Instead, he saw something worse. At 2:14 a.m., Marchand came out of the building, got into the silver truck, drove off. Riker tailed him with headlights off. Marchand didn't go far. He drove out to the woods just past Millstone Ridge, parked on a dirt trail, and stepped into the trees. He was carrying something. Riker couldn't see what, but he waited. 5 minutes, 10, 15. Marchand returned empty-handed. Riker noted the spot, logged the time. He didn't confront him? Not yet. He needed more. He needed proof. The next morning, Riker returned to the woods. He parked in the same spot, walked the same trail, and searched every patch of soil that looked disturbed. It took nearly 2 hours, but then, near the edge of a dry creek bed, he saw it. A series of fresh footprints, and a glint of metal beneath the leaves. He brushed the dirt away carefully. It was a locket. Inside was a photo of a young woman. Not Ivy, not Camilla, someone else. Another face, another thread, and scratched into the back of the locket. Forgive me. Riker stood in the silence of the forest, heart thudding. This wasn't just a pattern anymore. It was a graveyard of stories no one had told. Back at home, Riker laid everything out. Four women, same town, same vanishings. One man whose life moved quietly through the gaps of police files and procedural mistakes. He reached for his phone. Before he could dial, it buzzed. Blocked number. He answered. This time the voice was different. It was shaking. feminine. Whispering, "You need to stop," it said. "He's not working alone." Then silence. Chapter 3. A Face in the Dark. She hadn't said her name. Just 5 words. Software, shaky. Terrified. "You need to stop. He's not working alone." And then, nothing. Riker held the phone in his hand long after the line went dead. The way she said it, like a warning, not a threat. Like someone who knew what it meant to be watched, controlled, erased. His mind spun. If Marchand wasn't working alone, then this wasn't just about a single predator with a secret past. This was bigger, systemic, organized, and Riker had just kicked the hornet's nest. That afternoon, he returned to his small one-bedroom apartment and pulled the blinds tight. He turned off his phone, disconnected the Wi-Fi, and opened a separate secure laptop he rarely used, one not connected to anything except electricity. He began compiling everything. Victims. Casey Lynn Weller, 2001, 16, vanished after choir. Ivy Monroe, 2021, 17, vanished walking home from school. Camilla Briggs, 2024, 22, disappeared after work shift. Alana Drew, 2011, married to Marchand, never heard from again. Unknown locket girl, found in the woods, face yet to be identified. He added details, dates, locations, timelines, and then he ran facial analysis software. Ivy, Casey, Camilla, same cheekbones, same eye structure, same narrow jaw. Someone was choosing victims who looked like each other. This wasn't random. It was ritualistic. That night, Riker made a decision. He called an old partner. Detective Elise Navarro had been with the force for 10 years before transferring to state investigations. She was sharp, relentless, and the only person Riker still trusted. When she picked up, her tone was guarded. "Riker," she said, "you picking fights again?" "Something like that," he replied. "I need your help, but off the record." A pause. "Elise," he added, voice lowering, "it's happening again. Girls are going missing. I think I found who's behind it. Maybe more than one." She sighed. "Where do I meet you?" They sat in his apartment an hour later, staring at the board of victims. Elise crossed her arms. "You think this Marchand guy's your link?" "He's not just a link," Riker said. "He's part of it. Maybe not the leader, but a handler, a collector." Elise's eyes narrowed. "You're saying this is a ring?" "I'm saying the same vehicle shows up near at least 2 disappearances. There's a hidden locket in the woods, and I just got a call from someone who sounds like she's trapped." Elise rubbed her forehead. "And the department doesn't know?" "They closed Ivy's case in 6 months. Camilla's in active status, but no leads. Casey's was buried 20 years ago. And Alana Drew? She doesn't even exist in any database anymore." "Jesus," Elise whispered. "Who the hell cleans files like that?" "Someone with access." They agreed to meet again in 2 days. Elise promised to quietly pull what she could from internal systems. Riker stayed behind, revisiting the audio from the call. He had a recording app running. It was fuzzy, but he isolated the voice. Female, mid to late 20s, slight accent, maybe rural Tennessee. He fed the clip into a matching algorithm, hoping for a miracle. And he got one. Partial vocal match. Sadie Byrne, reported missing in 2022 from a foster home 3 towns over. Sadie had vanished during a routine visit to a career fair. No signs of struggle, no calls, no digital footprints. She was 17 then, and now, somehow, she had just called him. The next morning, Riker returned to Millstone Ridge. This time, he didn't search for evidence. He searched for Sadie. He followed the path Marchand had taken, past the creek bed, through a narrow trail of birch trees. And then he saw it, a clearing. At the far end stood a rusted hunting cabin, half collapsed, but parts of it looked recently used. He approached slowly. Inside was empty, dusty, except one room in the back had new locks on the inside. The walls were lined with foam insulation, and in the corner sat a small cot, clean sheets, and a water jug half full. Someone had been there. Recently, he stepped into the middle of the room and closed his eyes. He could feel it. This was a holding place, a transition point, for moving victims, for prepping them. He took photos of everything, footprints, scratches on the inside of the door, a single gold bracelet with the name Sadie, etched faintly. She'd been here, and she'd escaped. That night, Riker waited. He returned to the clearing and parked far off in the brush, hidden. At 1:47 a.m., the sound of tires. A vehicle slowed near the cabin. Silver truck. Marchand. He stepped out and approached the door with a flashlight, opened it, checked inside. He looked calm. Too calm. Then he spoke. "You left the bracelet, sweetheart," he said out loud. "But don't worry," he added, smiling to no one. "I'll come find you soon." He turned, got back into his truck, and left. Riker gripped his camera with shaking hands. It wasn't the smile that haunted him. It was the way Marchand had said it. Not like a threat, like a promise. The next day, Riker met with Elise again. They sat in a quiet corner of an old diner on the edge of town. She slid a file across the table. "You were right," she said. "Martian's original wife, Alana Drew, was listed in the system under a false ID. She applied for a new identity through a back channel tied to a retired cop named Vincent Rourke. Rourke was dismissed for misconduct in 2009.
"Misconduct?" Riker asked.
"Harassment, tampering with evidence. They never proved it. But internal whispers say he covered for someone more powerful." "And he disappeared?" Elise nodded. "Went off grid. No forwarding address." Riker leaned back, heart racing. "It's a network," he said quietly.
"Looks like it," Elise replied. "They made a plan. Elise would trace Rourke's known contacts. Riker would keep the heat on Marchand. They'd follow both trails until they met in the middle. And maybe, just maybe, find Sadie before she vanished again. But deep down, Riker feared the worst. Because whoever was behind this wasn't just taking women. They were erasing them. And now, they knew he was watching." Chapter 4, The Trap. The plan was never to confront Marchand. Not yet. Riker had been in this game long enough to know if you corner a man too soon, he gets sloppy. But not sloppy enough to get caught. He disappears. Or worse, he accelerates. That's what predators do when they feel the leash tug. But tonight was different. Tonight, Marchand was going to slip. Because Riker was going to set the bait, Elise had found something. She came by just after sunset, eyes wild, knuckles white around a slim flash drive. "I traced the Rourke connection," she said, breathless. "He had one consistent contact for the last 6 years, a nonprofit in Ashbridge called the Hallow Foundation." Riker raised an eyebrow. "Missing girls, foster system support. At first glance, they look clean, but I dug into their financials. Donations from shell companies, multiple aliases, and two of the missing girls, Sadie Byrne and Casey Weller, they were both listed as participants in community outreach programs sponsored by Hallow." Riker stared at her. "You're telling me this charity was used to scout victims?" Elise nodded. "And launder money, and maybe even move people." Riker paced the room. The pieces were fitting. Too perfectly. They weren't chasing a lone wolf. They were chasing a syndicate, a well-funded, well-connected web that had spent years operating in silence. Now it was time to break the silence. Riker made the call that night. Not to the police, to Sadie. The number was scrambled, encrypted through three different anonymizers, but Elise had traced it back to a burner network often used by whistleblowers. He typed in the code and hit record. "I know who you are," he said. "I found the bracelet. I know what they did to you. I want to help, but I can't do it alone." He paused. "I need you to call me back. Tonight, if you trust me. Give me a name." He ended the message. Then he waited. At 2:17 a.m., his phone buzzed. "Private number." He answered. There was a long silence. Then a voice, quiet, strained. "Don't follow them into the tunnels." Riker froze. "Tunnels?" "The Hallow House," she whispered. "They built tunnels under it, for moving us, for training us." Riker's blood turned to ice. Sadie continued. "There's a room, with photographs. Every girl, every stage. You'll know it when you see it." "Sadie, where are you now?" But the line went dead. The next morning, Riker and Elise sat outside the Hallow Foundation's property. It looked ordinary enough, a faded blue colonial building surrounded by hedges and a gravel path. But Riker had seen enough fronts to recognize a lie when it was painted pastel. They parked down the block and waited. At 10:03 a.m., Marchand arrived. He wasn't alone. With him was a tall, suited man, gray hair, perfect posture, sunglasses that didn't come off. "Rourke," Elise whispered. They watched the two men enter the building. They stayed for 26 minutes. No deliveries. No meetings. Just silence. And then they left. Riker turned to Elise. "We go in tonight." At midnight, they returned in black clothing, gloves, and soft-soled boots. Elise had secured an unregistered drone and disabled the nearest street cam from her laptop. They approached the rear entrance, cutting the lock with silent bolt cutters. Inside, the air was sterile. Too clean. Like someone was hiding rot beneath bleach. They moved through offices, storage closets, fake file cabinets filled with blank pages. But then, behind the reception desk, Riker noticed scuff marks on the floor. He moved the bookshelf. There was a hatch. Steel, locked with a keypad. Elise cracked it in 60 seconds. They descended into darkness. The tunnels beneath Hallow were cold, narrow, and built with intention. The first hallway held crates, wooden, reinforced. Labels were vague. Supplies, emergency gear. But Riker pried one open. Inside were restraints. Chains, gags, zip ties, cloth hoods. Elise whispered, "This isn't a charity. It's a holding facility." They moved deeper. Then Riker saw it. The room Sadie described. White walls, lined with photos. Rows of them, organized by year. Girls in stages. Arrival, grooming, compliance. Each face more hollow than the last. At the far end was a corkboard. It held one large photo. Riker's face. Below it, interference. Then, click. The lights shut off. Metal clanged behind them. The hatch had sealed. They were locked in. Flashlights snapped on. Riker pulled his weapon. "Elise, backup exit?" "There's no signal down here." They scanned the room. A second door, heavy, steel-bolted. No handle. Footsteps echoed. Someone was coming. Riker whispered, "We make a stand here. We don't run." He leveled his gun. Then the footsteps stopped, and a voice spoke. Calm. Cold. "Detective Riker, you've come so far, but you never learned rule number one." Riker tensed. "Don't chase ghosts that already buried you." A slot opened in the steel door. A small vial rolled across the floor, clear liquid, labeled only with one word, remember. Riker stared at it, then back at Elise. They were no longer hunting. They were being tested. Chapter 5. The Memory Vial. Riker stared at the vial on the floor. Remember. It glinted under the narrow beam of his flashlight, the label clean, deliberately typed in bold black ink, like someone wanted him to read it, to hold it, to decide. Behind him, Elise kept her weapon trained on the steel door. You think it's a drug? She asked quietly. Riker didn't answer. He bent down, picked up the vial. It was cold in his hand. Too cold for something that had been underground. This was stored, he said, inspecting it. Recently, probably refrigerated. He popped open the cap and gave it a cautious sniff. No distinct odor, but the liquid inside was cloudy, suspiciously thick. It wasn't a warning. It was a message. Whatever they're doing, he muttered, it isn't just physical. It's psychological. Elise didn't like it. She wanted to destroy the vial, gather evidence, get out. But Riker had seen this kind of thing before, not in Cedar Hollow, but overseas, during his brief time consulting on a trafficking case in Eastern Europe. Memory drugs, dissociatives, methods used to erase, reprogram, and control. He'd heard rumors of girls injected with mixtures that scrambled the timeline of their own trauma so they couldn't remember who had hurt them or when. If that's what remember meant, then someone was mocking him, or someone was offering him a truth he hadn't yet earned. Suddenly, a click echoed from behind the wall. The steel door unlatched. It opened on its own. No voice, no threat, just cold air rushing out like a breath held too long. Elise motioned to Riker. Stay behind me, she whispered. They stepped into a long corridor lined with concrete and steel grates. No cameras, no lights, except the kind that flickered and hummed like they hadn't been checked in years. But then they reached a room, a circular space maybe 20 feet across. At its center, a steel examination chair bolted to the ground. Leather straps hung loosely at the arms and ankles. The walls were papered with photographs, dozens, hundreds. And they weren't just pictures of victims, they were frames of video, still captures. Riker's blood froze. Every image showed a woman mid-scream, mid-resistance, mid-sedation, and in each, a man stood behind her. Marchand, and someone else. Riker! He stumbled backward, shaking his head. That's not... Elise grabbed his arm. Look at me. These are doctored. They don't look doctored, he whispered. And they didn't. Lighting matched. Shadows matched. His face, young, clean-shaven, just like in his academy days, standing behind girls he didn't remember, holding tools he didn't recognize. Deepfakes, Elise said again. This is how they protect themselves. They twist everything. Riker wanted to believe that, but in the far left corner, one photo caught his eye. A girl, tied to the chair, hair soaked, eyes shut, necklace with a broken chain. He stepped closer. The girl's face, Sadie, only younger, 15 maybe, and in the photo she was holding the same vial. Remember. That's when the door slammed shut behind them. This time, it didn't lock, but a low hiss began to sound in the walls. Gas. Elise cursed, pulled a handkerchief over her mouth. Move! They ran back down the corridor, but the walls had shifted. Doors that were once open were now sealed. They were being herded, pushed, manipulated, like mice in a maze. And the vial in Riker's pocket burned against his chest like it wanted to be used. Finally, they reached a narrow stairwell. At the top, another steel door. This one opened into daylight, blinding, hot, mid-afternoon sun. They weren't in the city anymore. They were in the woods, not far from Millstone Ridge. The Hallow Foundation wasn't just an outreach center. It was a gateway, one with multiple exits, hidden in plain sight. They stumbled into the clearing, lungs aching, adrenaline still roaring. Riker pulled the vial out and stared at it again. "Whoever's running this," he said, "they're not just torturing people. They're rewriting them." Elise didn't speak. She just pointed to the trees. Footprints. Fresh. And then, from the shadows, a voice. "Put it down, Riker." Marchand stepped out from behind a pine. No gun. No fear. Like he already knew how this would end. "You're not going to like what you find," he said. Riker raised his weapon. "Try me. You think you're the hero in this? You think this is about missing girls, corrupted files, bad cops?" He stepped closer. "But it's not. It's about you." Riker kept the gun trained. "You're not walking away." Marchand chuckled. "I never planned to." He stepped forward again, arms raised, palms open. Elise fired. One shot, clean. Marchand dropped to the ground, chest bleeding out. But even as he died, he smiled. "You still don't remember," he whispered. "You never will." Riker dropped to his knees beside the body. He stared at the man's blank, fading eyes, then pulled out the vial. "Remember." And for the first time, he wondered, what if this wasn't for the victims? What if it was for him? Chapter 6, The False Memory. Riker hadn't slept, not since they left Marchand's body cooling in the woods. Not since Elise dumped the vial in a sealed evidence bag and warned him not to touch it again. But he couldn't stop thinking about it. Remember. That one word played on a loop in his mind, louder than the gunshot, sharper than Marchand's final words. "You never will." Elise was calm, composed. She'd already contacted her contacts in state. A quiet team came to extract Marchand's body and sweep the hidden tunnels under Hallow. But by morning, everything was gone. Wiped clean. The photos, the chair, the gas vents, all gone. Even the steel door they'd entered through had been replaced by solid concrete. Like it never existed. Like they imagined it. Riker knew better. This wasn't paranoia. This was precision. They were dealing with people who had resources, surveillance, political protection, and worse, the ability to rewrite the truth. And the more Riker tried to piece the case together, the more holes he found in his own memory. He couldn't remember his last conversation with Ivy Monroe before she disappeared. He couldn't remember why he was pulled from the original investigation. He couldn't remember the night his badge was revoked. Only flashes, red lights, a scream, a flashlight flickering against broken glass, and a face, his face, in a mirror, with blood on his hands. He drove for hours, not to think, just to move, to breathe. He ended up at the edge of town, where the road met the abandoned industrial district, a place with no cameras, no witnesses, no reason to exist anymore. He parked, stepped out, and sat on the hood of his car. The wind was sharp, the silence deeper than it should have been. He reached into his coat, pulled out the vial. It was still cool, still labeled, still whispering, "Remember." Back in town, Elise was panicking. She hadn't heard from him in hours. She checked hospitals, police channels, called his burner. Nothing. Then she remembered what he told her once, after a case that almost ended them both. "If I disappear," he'd said, "check the place where they buried the truth." She pulled up his location history. There it was. Cedar Hollow Asylum. Closed in 1999 after a fire. Never demolished. Just left to rot. A perfect place to be forgotten. Or to remember. Riker stood in the shattered hallway of the old asylum, dust curling around his boots. The broken ceiling groaned. The air smelled like mold and something older, like pain that never left. He moved slowly. Each room looked the same. Empty gurneys, peeling wallpaper, rusted restraints. But one room had power. A single bulb hung from the ceiling, flickering weakly above a leather chair bolted to the floor. And on the chair, a file, labeled Riker C. He opened it with trembling hands. Inside were pages of psychiatric evaluations, notes dated during the same year Ivy Monroe disappeared. They claimed he'd suffered a breakdown, that he'd been found near the bus terminal at 3:18 a.m., covered in blood, disoriented, repeating the same phrase. She said, "Don't look away." The file said he was held under psychiatric watch for 72 hours, but he had no memory of it. There were signed orders by Chief Waller, by Dr. Vernon, and by Marchand. Marchand was a police medic? Riker staggered backward. Everything was blurring now. He felt the weight of the vial in his pocket like it was pulling him into the floor. He pulled it out, uncapped it, and drank. The world twisted. Not fast, but like film burning slowly through a projector. His hands shook, his eyes blurred, and then he was standing in Ivy Monroe's room. Not in memory, but present. She was there. 17, laughing, writing something in her journal. Then he saw himself, younger, in uniform, smiling at her through the doorway. They were close, too close. He felt it in his bones. Not romantic, not improper, but dangerous. Because she trusted him. Because she knew something. He followed the vision as it shifted. A storm. Blue flashing lights. Ivy, screaming. Not at someone. At him. "You promised," she shouted. "You said they wouldn't take me." Then, silence. Blood. And the mirror again. His face. Blank. Riker hit the ground of the asylum hard, gasping for breath. The hallucination faded, but the truth remained. He hadn't hurt Ivy. He'd failed her. She'd trusted him to protect her from them. And he hadn't. Because he didn't know. Because his memory had been taken. He stumbled outside just as Elise pulled up. She ran to him, grabbed his shoulders. "What the hell happened?" "They erased me," Riker whispered. "Ivy, she tried to warn me. I was too late." "You drank it?" she said, horrified. "I had to." He handed her the file. "We were never looking at the surface, Elise. This thing goes deeper than tunnels or nonprofits. It's an entire network of erasure. They don't just silence girls. They destroy the people who try to help them." Elise stared at the file. "How much do you remember now?" "Enough to know who's next." He pulled a torn photo from his jacket. It was of Sadie Byrne. And behind her, a man. Not Marchand. Not Rourke. Someone worse. Chief Harold Waller, still in uniform, still running Cedar Hollow. Chapter 7, The Final Girl. The storm broke over Cedar Hollow just after 9 p.m. Darkness rolled in heavy. Thunder cracked like it was trying to split the sky in two. Rain hit the pavement in sheets, and the streets emptied fast. But Riker and Elise were already moving. No lights, no phones, no backup. Just two people armed with the truth and the names of the men who built their empire on silence. At the center of it all stood Chief Harold Waller. Decorated, beloved, untouchable. But Riker knew better now. He remembered the day Waller pulled him from Ivy Monroe's case. He remembered the fake psych hold. He remembered the chair, the gas, the photographs, all of it designed not to kill, but to confuse, to erase. This wasn't corruption. It was a system. And the only way to break it was to burn it down. They parked three blocks from Waller's estate. A mansion dressed as a farmhouse. Whitewashed siding, tall hedges, a big porch wrapped around the front. The perfect cover for a man who pretended to be everyone's grandfather. Inside, Waller was hosting a retirement party. For himself. Walking away before the walls close in, Elise whispered. Riker nodded.
Not if we close them first. They slipped around the back and climbed through a dark utility room. No alarms. Waller didn't expect enemies anymore. Everyone who ever tried had disappeared or forgotten why they were trying in the first place. But Riker hadn't forgotten. Not anymore. They moved through the house like ghosts. Laughter floated down from the upstairs sitting room. Waller's voice, calm, charming, the same tone he used when he first shook Riker's hand a decade ago. The same tone he used when he lied to Ivy's mother. Riker held the vial in his palm. Empty now, but still cold, still real. They reached the study. Waller's private room. Elise picked the lock in seconds. Inside, dark wood shelves, trophies, awards, newspaper clippings, and behind the desk, a cabinet with a digital lock. Riker entered the code he'd seen in the hallucination. 0317, Ivy's birthday. Click. The door opened. Inside were files, dozens of them, hard drives, photos, and one envelope, thick and sealed with wax. Riker opened it. Inside were photos of Sadie Byrne. Not missing. Not dead. Alive. And held in a compound north of the city, one owned by Pine Grove Behavioral Services, a private medical contractor used by local law enforcement. Another front. Another cage. They had to move fast. Elise took the files and called her contact in state intelligence. Riker slid the photos into his coat. They left without alerting anyone. But Riker glanced up once, through the staircase railings, and saw Waller staring down from the top floor. He didn't speak. Just smiled. Like he knew. The compound was surrounded by woods and fences and quiet guards with lazy eyes. No cameras, just a long gravel road and a single metal door at the end of the corridor labeled Patient Recovery. They waited until dawn. Then Elise walked in, dressed as a department inspector. Riker followed 5 minutes later through the rear hallway, picking the locks with a quiet rage burning in his chest. Room 9B. That was the one. He pushed the door open. And there she was. Sadie Byrne. Hair longer, paler, but awake. Sitting upright. Eyes locked on him the second he entered. Riker, she said quietly. You remember me? He asked. Of course, she whispered. You're the one they couldn't erase. She stood slowly. No restraints. No sedation. They said if I ever left, they'd find my little sister. That's why I stayed. Riker nodded. Not anymore. He turned. Elise was already outside the room, whispering into a burner phone. 10 minutes later, the state team arrived. Pine Grove was raided. Files seized. Patients freed. Waller was arrested in his driveway, in front of the morning news. But he didn't fight. Didn't flinch. When asked if he had anything to say, he simply whispered, "They'll never stop coming." That night, Riker sat outside Ivy Monroe's childhood home. Her mother had passed the year before. The house was quiet, empty. But he walked up anyway, left a single photograph in the mailbox. It was of Ivy and Sadie, side by side, thanks to AI reconstruction. The two girls who started and finished it all. At the bottom of the photo, Riker wrote one line. You were never forgotten. Epilogue. 3 weeks later, Riker received a letter. No return address. Inside was a photograph. Of Elise. Taken from a rooftop. Zoomed in. Behind her, scribbled in faint red marker. She remembers too. Riker closed the envelope. He wasn't done. Not yet. Because every time a system dies, something else grows in the cracks. And next time, it might be watching him.